We continue our discussions on BCUCC.
Thank you very much, Hans. So moving on to agenda paper 6 and 6A. So what we would like to achieve at this session, we would like to get your feedback on the approaches that are currently being developed by the staff on business regulations and economic control. What I would like to emphasize is that everything is in this slide deck is work in process, and it reflects where our thinking was at the time of posting the slide deck. One of the questions on slide 24 was subject to June's core discussion, and following that discussion, we posted sort of an updated paper which refined the question on slide 24. And so what I would like to do, I will skip a few initial slides in the interest of time and really focus on the approaches. And we have questions on different approaches, and I would like to take you through our thinking on all those approaches, so then when you can provide feedback, you have the context and you have a big picture. So with that, I would like to start on slide 9. And just to remind all of you that in this project, we are focusing on the financial statements of the receiving entity, combination under common control. And of course, under the conceptual framework, we are interested in information needs of primary users of these entities' financial statements. So if you move to slide 10 considers different types of primary users of receiving entities' financial statements. And there are a couple of points that I wanted to highlight on this slide. So first of all, we would like to look at existing non-controlling shareholders and existing lenders and creditors in the receiving entity. And there are a couple of things which are very similar for those types of users and also things that are different. So the similarity between existing non-controlling shareholders and existing lenders and creditors is, of course, that the transaction can affect their existing interest, which is different from prospective shareholders in an IPO. However, there is also an important difference, arguably important difference, between existing NCI and lenders and creditors. And the differences are that NCI are subject to residual equity risks in the acquirer, and their interest in the acquirer is indefinite. In contrast, lenders and creditors are not exposed to residual equity risks. They are exposed to credit risk and liquidity risk. And also their interest in receiving entity is finite. So that's potentially something we need to keep in mind when we think about what and how information should be provided. Now, the interesting thing about the controlling party is that even though it is a primary user of the receiving entity financial statements, but the controlling party controls all combining entities before and after the transaction, and also it does not rely on the financial statements of the receiving entity as a single source of information about the transaction. And finally, as I mentioned already, that prospective capital providers, they don't have any existing interest in the acquirer, so they will invest in the future in whatever is the reporting entity at that time. And sort of that analysis at a very high level seems to suggest that information needs of different types of users can be different, and also cost-benefit analysis of that information for different types of users may be different. Now, if we move to slide 11, which outlines at a very high level three basic approaches that we could consider for business combinations under common control. Again, there are differences in how each of those approaches could be applied, but at 30,000 feet, if we look at historical cost, ultimately it would mean some form of allocation of the fair value of the consideration transferred to acquired assets and liabilities. If we look at current value approach, it essentially means recognizing acquired assets and liabilities at some form of current value and recognizing goodwill. And finally, if we look at predecessor carry and amounts approach, then again, that would involve using some sort of predecessor carry and amounts for acquired assets and liabilities. And really what the remainder of this slide deck is doing, it considers what different approaches would provide in different circumstances, and it considers whether it is likely to provide useful information for different types of users at a cost justified by the benefit. If we look at slide 12, so this is sort of our basic, I suppose, picture that we will be looking at. And so what we will be doing throughout the slide deck, we will keep right-hand side of this picture constant, so we always have same fair value of acquired business and synergies, same fair value of the identifiable net assets, same carrying amounts of the acquired net assets. And then by changing consideration, we will look at scenarios where equal values are exchanged or higher value is received or given up. And one item I wanted to highlight on this slide, which is going back to the discussion about substance that we had before lunch and whether the substance is always or sometimes the same or whether it can be different. So under IFRS 3, in a business combination between unrelated parties, there is an assumption that fair value of consideration transferred approximates fair value of the acquired interest. And fair value of the acquired interest really includes fair value of the acquired business and any synergies that we expect to derive from the transaction. And of course, fair value is never a single number. It's always a range. But in principle, this is what it captures. Now, in a business combination under common control, of course, fair value of the consideration transferred may or may not approximate fair value of what is current value, I should say, of what is received. And the question is, if there is a difference, should it be accounted for as contribution or distribution, and how we measure it? And of course, in extreme circumstances, you can have a situation where one subsidiary is contributed to another subsidiary for new consideration, just as a contribution. With that, if we very quickly flip through the scenarios, starting on slide 15. So if we were to apply a historical cost approach to a scenario where equal values are exchanged, so the outcome would be that fair value of consideration transferred is allocated by some method to acquired assets and liabilities, and that would result in recognizing acquired assets and liabilities at amounts that are higher than both the predecessor carrying amounts and the fair values, of course, assuming that there is goodwill in this business. So essentially, that would result in overstating assets and liabilities, which in the future could trigger impairment testing, and it does not reflect the fact that transaction has taken place at fair value. Moving on to slide 16, if we have a scenario where higher value is given up and we apply a historical cost approach, we get essentially the same outcome. So again, acquired assets and liabilities would be overstated, but even by a high amount, and again, you will have an impairment test. And this accounting method would not reflect the fact that higher value has been given up. And finally, moving on to slide 17, if we have a scenario where a higher value is received and we apply historical cost approach, we allocate. So in that case, we would not necessarily overstate acquired assets and liabilities, but we would end up with some sort of arbitrary numbers allocated to those acquired assets and liabilities. And again, that method would not reflect the fact that a higher value is received in the transaction. So on slide 18 is staff's initial assessment that approach does not really seem to provide useful information to any types of primary users in the receiving entity. Now, I would like to skip current value approach and first talk about the predecessor approach and then come back to current value. So predecessor approach starts on slide 26. So if we look at a scenario where equal values are exchanged in the transaction, application of the predecessor method would result in recognition of assets and liabilities at their predecessor carrying amounts, and we will recognize a distribution It may not necessarily be as large as sort of graphically it seems on that slide, but still we would recognize a distribution even though equal values are exchanged in a transaction. Moving on to slide 27, if high value is given up, again, a predecessor approach would recognize a distribution, which in principle is, of course, correct because we've given up a higher value, but then the amount of distribution will be much higher than the actual value given up. If we are in a scenario, moving on to slide 28, where a higher value is received, if we apply the predecessor approach, depending on the exact difference, depending on how much exactly we've paid, we can have a situation where we recognize a contribution, but again, as you can see on the slide, the amount of the contribution does not really represent the actual difference in the values exchanged. But also, moving on to slide 29, you can have a situation where a higher value is received, but you recognize a distribution instead of a contribution applying the predecessor value approach. So moving on to slide 30, we don't really think that such an approach would provide useful information to existing non-controlling shareholders in the receiving entity. We can see that that approach might work in a situation where you don't have any external shareholders. You don't have any external lenders and creditors. All you have is just a controlling party. So arguably, you know, using a predecessor values method could work in those circumstances. It does not involve costs, and controlling party knows what's going on anyway. What we do in a scenario where you have a controlling party plus lenders and creditors, this is something we're still thinking about. And finally, moving on to a current value approach, which starts on slide 20. And again, there are different ways how you can apply current value approach, and this is one of our questions. But sort of the objective would be, if we look at slide 20, if equal values are exchanged, ideally a current value approach would recognize acquired net assets at fair values, and it would recognize goodwill as a difference between consideration transfer and fair value of the acquired net assets, and that goodwill really would represent any goodwill that was previously generated in the acquired business plus any synergies that are included in the consideration. If we are in a scenario where a high value is given up on slide 21, and we apply a current value approach, ideally, what we would recognize in those circumstances, again, we recognize acquired net assets at fair value. We recognize goodwill that represents goodwill previously generated in the acquired business and any combination synergies. And ideally, we would want to recognize a distribution that reflects the difference between values exchanged. And finally, moving on to slide 22, if we apply current value approach to a scenario where a high value is received, again, we would recognize same amount of goodwill, same amount of identifiable net assets. We would recognize a contribution to equity is the difference between the values exchanged. And on slide 23, our initial assessment is that if you have existing non-controlling shareholders in the receiving entity, a current value approach would provide useful information to those primary users, and arguably the benefits of that information would justify the costs of providing that information. And finally, the question becomes, if we were to apply current value approach to those scenarios where you have existing NCI, how do you actually operationalize what we're trying to achieve? And the staff have considered a number of approaches that were discussed by the board. So we've considered an approach which we called a ceiling approach, where we use fair value of the acquired business as a reference point. So if you pay more than fair value of the acquired business, you have a distribution. If you pay less than fair value of the acquired business, you have a contribution. That was one of the approaches we considered. We considered another approach, which we referred to as revised ceiling approach, where we use the mechanics of the impairment test in IAS 36 to identify any overpayment. And where the board landed, so the board's direction for the staff in June was to use the acquisition method as a starting point for transactions that involve non-controlling shareholders and think about whether and how that method could be modified. And it could be as simple as providing additional disclosures. It could involve, instead of recognizing a gain, recognizing a contribution to equity. And finally, it could involve trying to capture any such overpayment, either by looking at fair value of the acquired business or by applying the mechanics of the impairment test. So that's something for us to consider. With that, our questions for you are, what are your views on the staff's initial assessment for different approaches for different types of primary users, and also whether you agree that the acquisition method in IFRS 3 could and should be modified for transactions that involve NCI, and if so, what those modifications should be?
Alexander.
The input that I received from the financial jurisdiction relates to a point that I think Andreas mentioned in his last comment, last session, is that maybe different approach to represent different situation in terms of, because you may argue that a given transaction has no economic substance, but it may have happened. So how to account for a transaction that has no economic substance? So what the input that I received is that the current value approach is better suited for transactions that have economic substance. So it's a real business combination. And people actually added the element of, is the controlling shareholder voting on that transaction or not? I forgot to mention that's a point that people... Because you have independent non-controlling shareholders on both companies that are merging under some circumstances. Is the only the controlling shareholder dictating that transaction, or the non-controlling shareholders actually favoring that? And the, do you understand the point?
Yes, I'm just listening. Yeah,
it's an important one, because if non-controlling shareholders want to have that transaction, that's an additional element that would favor that transaction as an independent transaction, a transaction with independent parties, because there are different shareholders contracting.
Can I just clarify? So you are saying if there is economic substance, then you do some sort of current value accounting.
Yeah.
And then if there is no economic substance...
Yes, then becomes very...
Do something different.
This was possible. That's quite unanimous. Most people agree on that version. So if there is no economic substance, but the transaction actually happened, so people are free to contract and they transact. So there are mixed views here, but none in favor of the recognition of, especially people against recognition of goodwill. You should not recognize goodwill on a non substantial transaction. That's the input we see. So if there is economic substance, treat it as a business combination in IFRS 3. Pretty much the same approach with some modifications here. But if there is no economic substance, people didn't like very much the predecessor method. Predecessor method, in my view, would be most appropriate, because we didn't have a distribution. Why would you pay more for that? But again, there was no consensus about it. What to do if there is no economic?
And was there any consensus about what is versus what is not economic substance?
On the top of that, one thing that people, on the top of the list that Hong Kong paper brought, there is this tax implication that is really important, because especially in Brazil, that goodwill is tax deductible, so there's a lot of business combinations that are motivated by that. And the other one was this relationship between who is voting for that. Because what you have is that we have controlling shareholder here and have different shareholders below. And if independent shareholders are voting, especially on the price, they agree with the price. So that's a third party. That's a transaction of a third party. So it's not a controlling shareholder transacting with himself on both sides.
So it does come back to the question whether it is fair value or not. It's one of the considerations that is important.
With fair value. So maybe there is an expert opinion on that, but the important point is that non-controlling shareholders on both sides of the transaction, the buyer and the seller, mm-hmm. agree with the price.
Okay.
That was an additional element.
Jo?
Yes. Thank you. Basically, we do not agree with the current value approach for any of the modification based on this approach, including the ceiling approach and the revised ceiling. And that's the first point I want to make. And the second one is that we are quite concerned that more fair value is used in this analysis. We all know that there are many BCUCC cases in China, and there are cases when the fair value of the value exchanged are different. However, it is almost practically impossible to decide the fair value of the business and the synergies in many cases, which includes the fair value of the net assets recognized and the internally generated goodwill and synergies. We all know that internally generated goodwill currently is not recognized, mainly because it cannot measure it reliably. And synergies are not obviously during the early stages of the business combinations. So it can be very difficult to decide the fair value of the business exchanged and the synergies. So we are quite concerned that currently the staff analysis is based on the presumption that the fair value exchange may be different. And going down that path, we think that fair value may be abused for BCUCC accounting. And the third point I want to make is that the major question here is what really triggered the remeasurement of the asset. And we think that should be the change of the control.
Linda?
So I'd like to clarify something, because in every example you have in this deck, you assume that there is a fair value component. And yet I heard you say earlier, Peter, that you don't think a transaction that lacks substance fits within the scope. So let me clarify what I mean. The vast majority, by like a huge multiple, call it 70-80% of the transactions in Canada, which we would call business combinations under common control, are really rearranging the deck chairs within the corporate entity. And most often they're tax-driven. So what's not clear to me from what you're proposing here was would those fall into these models? Because if so, then it concerns me that at the corporate level, you would somehow change values for something that happens solely within the corporate entity, even though there's separate entities. So I'm not clear whether those are in scope or out of scope in this step.
Right. So I'm not sure 100% understand the question, but let me try and answer and see if it sort of hits the point. So we are looking at all transactions within a group that involve a transfer of business within a group. So you can move the business from one entity to another. You can put like a legal wraparound around existing business. So this is all in scope. So we are looking at receiving entity in this business combination or in this reorganization. And what we're saying is, if you don't have existing NCI in this receiving entity, then maybe current value accounting will not result in useful information at the cost that is justified by the benefit, right? But if you have existing NCI, in the receiving entity. It's only this one particular scenario where we think that current value approach should be explored.
So we would be supportive of that.
Okay.
Okay, because just to add to the discussion, in Canada, there's no filing requirement for separate statements, unless, for instance, you're a regulated entity. So if you're an insurer, then there's a filing requirement with the regulator for those separate statements. But elsewhere, we don't have any particular filing requirement for separate statements, so that investors, and by the way, in your work, investors really don't have insight into most of these transactions. Because really the only evidence you have when it falls into the tax reorganizations is that you have a better effective tax rate at the end of the day, and there's minimal disclosure of those types of transactions. But if there is a third party, including non-controlling interests, then the fair value seems more appropriate. I would also add that when you show your slides about is the reporting effective, the controlling party doesn't need financial statements to get information. They got all the information. They're usually driving a lot of these transactions. I would also argue that lenders and creditors have access to all kinds of information, because if you want to keep your bank loans, you're going to give your lender the information they require. So I don't think they're reliant on financial statements for that type. I think that often we end up doing financial statements in this sector because the tax authority wants financial statements. And I don't see those guys mentioned anywhere, so I'll just add that. But at the end of the day, for us, it's a real delineation between whether or not there's a third party engaged at all. Okay. And secondly, we do think that you should really take into consideration cost-benefit. So if you've got a relatively small non-controlling interest, and that relatively small non-controlling interest is spread so that nobody has got, a large share, you really have to ask yourself, from a cost-benefit perspective, what do you achieve?
It's similar to the point in Brazil. People are saying that non-controlling shareholders should approve the transaction without interference of the controlling shareholder, just to make sure that is a real.
Yeah. So just some considerations. But as long as we understand that if you're rearranging the deck chairs and nothing has changed, no impact should flow up, then we would be supportive.
Christina.
Sorry, I couldn't hear. So AUSSG, most AUSSG members supported, I think, the staff's view and the analysis on the individual impact to the impact of individual stakeholder groups.
Yep.
The question that was commonly asked is, but obviously, if you're isolating those cases, then the analysis holds, but in listed companies, you have your NCI and then you have your control cost. And similar to some of the comments raised earlier, that they struggle to see, well, which primary users they need to prioritize. And obviously, the conceptual framework talks about, doesn't really give the answers. So perhaps some members have said, perhaps we need to really look at external primary users when we're thinking about this. So to really define controlling parties, they can get information, so it makes sense that we are looking at current values. There is nervousness about using current value though, so and I think similar to other jurisdictions, there some countries in AOSSG do not have sufficient evaluation resources and infrastructure. And talk about maybe even the governance is not as strong. So if we are moving that way for these types of transactions, particularly you're talking about listed entities with NCI, you could get the abuse point. So I think we might need to think about whether the purpose of this counseling would be to stop any anti-abuse, and perhaps maybe in certain jurisdictions it is, we might need the measurement uncertainty. Mm-hmm. But that's basically the most difficult thing for a lot of our jurisdictions.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Jim?
It was less clear to me that it was quite as black and white about the benefit to each group, including of carryover to the non-controlling shareholders. I think it was just stated as a fact versus here's why. And I struggled with that a little bit because I think you can make identical arguments if I just sold non-controlling interest. So I own 100% and a non-controlling interest holder buys 40. You could say, would they be better off with current value financial statements or predecessor, which leads you to pretty quickly a slippery slope that says, well, current, you should always current value the financial statements. Similarly, if it was better for users at the lower level, so you say non-controlling shareholders benefit there, then why wouldn't the shareholders of the parent be better off with step-up basis as well? That's exactly the accounting you would get if it was a business combination with a third party. So now it's under common control and we don't step those up at the parent, but if the argument is investors are better off, well, then why wouldn't parent shareholders be better off with new basis accounting? And so I think that that's a slippery slope. And then I wonder, really, are they always better off? For example, you have two entities under common control. You step up the IPR&D of one of those entities. I think investors are likely to want to back those measurements out, where you step up inventory and have no profit margin on the sales for the first 6 months of one of the entities under common control, but you continue to have a normal profit margin on the entity that wasn't stepped up. Do investors want no margin on half of the sales and full margin on the other half, or are they going to seek measures that try to isolate the impacts of purchase accounting? So again, it just wasn't quite as clear to me that that's really what they want going forward versus are investors, are non-controlling interest holders trying to figure out whether they got a benefit or taken advantage of out of the deal. And there may be a better way to do that than stepping up all of the assets and liabilities and impacting the accounting differentially going forward.
I just have one sort of observation, and I agree with those points, but I think those points could equally be made about a business combination between unrelated parties, because if you have a normal business combination and you have shareholders in the acquirer, for those shareholders, only acquired items will be stepped up, and items where they already have an interest will not be stepped up. So I think this argument would equally apply to unrelated acquisition.
No.
Thank you. I have 3 points. The first is that non-controlling interest could include thousands of shareholders with a very tiny stake in the entity, or a single shareholder holding 49% of the entity's shares. And we are not convinced that the acquisition method provides the most useful information in all variations of the composition of the non-controlling interest. My second point is that the objective of general-purpose financial statement is to provide an information set that will meet the needs of maximum number of primary users, and I think that means that you need to reconcile the needs of the four types that you've analyzed rather than picking which one you want to focus on.
Can you say the last bit again?
Sorry?
Can you repeat the last thought again, please?
So instead of picking one type of user you want to focus on, I think you're focusing on non-controlling interests. I think you need to reconcile the needs of the four types of users.
Andrew?
I'm sorry. I have one more point. While we understand that some BC-UCC transactions may not be an exchange of equals, we believe that the model should be developed assuming that the BCC is an exchange of equals. Because if requirements were to be developed for BC-UCCs that are not exchanges of equals, we think that the ISB will need to consider many other types of transactions that are currently assumed to be exchange of equals, such as related party transactions.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you. So we've been discussing various examples of business combinations under common control within FRAG, and I think for those that do affect the interest of non-controlling interests in the acquirer overall, I think the predominant view is that a method similar to the acquisition method is superior, or is the best starting point. That said, I would agree with Jim's comments around the risk of overstating the benefits of using current value for one part of the combining entities. And also, in terms of just comparing the acquisition method or similar to predecessor-type methods, I think it's important to bear in mind that the predecessor method is, a family of methods. One of the variations involves restating comparative information, and perhaps less so in this situation, but certainly in NewCo-type situations and the pre-IPO-type situations, there's a strong view that this comparative information is useful. The acquisition method just kind of leaves you with no history and a current value balance sheet, which would seem like a kind of limited information set on which to base an IPO investment decision. But anyway, on the non-controlling interest, we got that. I think within that, it is implicit that you are placing the needs of non-controlling interests as the paramount needs, and there's maybe you have to make that judgment to make progress, but there's not a particularly sound conceptual basis to emphasise the needs of one group of stakeholders, users over another. And also, I think, within that, a view that the non-controlling interests should be very interested in information about the fair value of what was paid and received by the entity in which they're invested. We didn't really get into the modifications of the acquisition method, so these are more personal reflections. I think it's implicit in this analysis that we're not looking at the accounting, identifying the accounting acquirer using IFRS 3 technology. We're assuming the legal acquirer is the accounting acquirer. And that certainly seems to be worth exploring in this context, given the difficulties of identifying which party really obtains control in a common control situation. Then we've got the question around, rather than just using the consideration and fair value of consideration, comparing that to the fair value of the net assets acquired, we, depending on which version of the current value method we use, we treat the fair value of the acquired business as a sort of deemed consideration and potentially recognise notional goodwill. I think that there's a conceptual basis, certainly, to say that an overpayment, if it's the right way around, an overpayment would be a distribution and an underpayment would be a contribution from equity participants. But applying that approach does mean that you've got to fair value the acquired business as well as fair valuing the consideration and the identifiable net assets acquired, so it's adding some complexity. Yet that number, the deemed under or overpayment, is going to be a very sensitive number, which may be a good reason to make it transparent, but it is going to be a sensitive number. And the estimation uncertainty in getting to that number, I think, should be weighed against the benefits that that number would deliver. And when I say sensitive, many jurisdictions, corporate laws have rules around transfers at undervalues. They have minority interest protection laws. This could all interact with some of that legislation. And there's a question here, any other modifications that are worth considering? I haven't quite worked this through, but IFRS 3 has an option on, if there are non-controlling interests in the acquired entity, so not the acquirer, the acquiree has non-controlling interests, IFRS 3 gives you an accounting policy choice to value those at fair value or at proportionate share in the underlying net assets. I wondered how the use of that choice would play out in these numbers, in the deemed distribution or contribution. As you're using fair value for NCI grosses up the goodwill, but given the sensitivity of the deemed distribution or contribution, you don't want to gross that number up. That should be based on the actual fair value of what you've paid and received.
We haven't gotten that deep into our analysis because we kind of want to understand the direction in the first place, and that's sort of level 3 or 4 in that analysis. But yes, I agree that this is something that would need to be thought through. Mm-hmm.
Tommaso.
I have some comments. First of all, I think there is a very good work. I mean, starting point of analyzing the different accounting models based on user needs, I think, is the right way to deal with the project. Then I think that in a way or another you should deal with the faithful representation of different accounting models just rather than focusing on user needs. About the users, on slide 10, I understood that non-controlling interest non-controlling shareholders are the current shareholders and prospective capital providers are potential users, potential investors. And going through the analysis, I understand that we can come to different conclusions from what current users and potential investors. I think we should, if we want to continue to this route, we should, in a way or another, argue why there should be different conclusions, different information needs between current users and potential one. I think that, for example, let me find one example. But for example, when we go to the current value approach, your work in progress, but for non-controlling interest, you say yes, it's useful information, but for potential investor is not. I cannot understand why. Then controlling party, I think that Linda is the point that they're not users. They don't need information. So why do we make our assessment based on somebody information needs if they are not users according to conceptual framework? Then I have a question about whether lenders and creditors in slide 23 would not be interested in the current value approach. I think that, we should probably argue a little bit more why, because I struggle with that. I think if I'm a lender and I see this transaction and I rely on the transaction itself, I would like to see the top up as well as it is a combination with third parties. Based on the models, I struggle a bit with this historical cost model, which is something that is not really so much discussed in literature. I think the models are current values and predecessor values. Historical cost would raise a number of issues, and you raise the main one, which is that could be necessary to make a day one impairment loss. Moreover, I agree with some comments that were made with Alexander that say that it depends on factor circumstances the model to be applied, and with something that was raised by Linda and Nobu about the concept of non-controlling interest, I think it's very important to try to understand what we mean for when non-controlling interests are relevant. We have a number of legislation, I think, in my country, but also in Europe, that make a protection to non-controlling interests and a number of laws and regulations for preparers to follow. Hope it's helpful.
Chris?
Thanks. I just had a few questions, if I could firstly go through. I was a little bit surprised in terms of all of these slides assume that there are synergies over the fair value of the acquired business. So it wasn't clear to me what you were thinking, because I would have expected in most cases that fair value of an acquired business will pick up some synergies. There might be some other things potentially, but my understanding was always that when you're looking at an asset that you're going to acquire, market participants would be thinking about how you could incorporate those assets within your own things, and that would already have some of that synergistic benefit in there. So I just wasn't sure what the thinking was.
So let me try and clarify this point. So first of all these illustrations, they sort of show what can be there. It doesn't mean that in every scenario both elements will be there, right? So when you look at the fair value of the acquired business, it is a market participant perspective. So if there are synergies that would be available to every market participant from that acquisition, then arguably it would be captured in the fair value of the acquired business. However, if there are any synergies that are unique to the combination of these two entities, those synergies and payment for those synergies would not be a part of fair value of the acquired business. It's sort of entity-specific or combination-specific concept. And again, I just want to emphasize, in a third-party business combination, whether and how much you pay for any such unique synergies will be essentially subject to negotiations. Mm. In a business combination under common control, you may not even have that element, but in principle, you know, it can exist. And we were trying to compare, of course, business combination under common control versus a regular business combination.
And that's what I just don't see that there's any difference. So I think you would still get the same issues in an acquisition with a third party. There could still well be other synergies that we wouldn't be recognising. So,
but with a third party, so the main point here is that in a third party, the price is negotiated. And so there is an assumption that the price that you pay, it represents the value of what you acquire. And the value of what you acquire, part of that can be fair value to the market, and part of your payment may be synergies unique to you. And under common control, you just can't make that assumption that what you pay approximates what you acquire. Because, as we said, in extreme circumstances, you can have just one business contributed to another business for nil consideration.
I think that's the case, but if your starting presumption, which I thought I heard you say, was that you were looking at the acquisition method for NCI, I would have thought there's a lot of jurisdictions like Australia and New Zealand where basically you would have to do the transaction at fair value. So otherwise it would be considered a fraud on the minority, mm-hmm. and you would have a whole lot of other issues that would come into play. So I think as part of this exercise, you really need to have an understanding of what you're trying to capture here. And if at the end all you're trying to do is deal with the NCIs, because there is a third-party relationship and you think that they're the most appropriate, then I'm not sure that you're going to need to go as far as what you're going with some of these other models. So anyway, it's just something to think about, and I think we all need to provide you with some data on what these types of transactions are and what sort of percentages are or aren't at fair value. Can you also just explain to me, because I was really, really struggling with the revised ceiling approach, which seemed to be implying that there was something else going on in an IS 36 impairment test about recognising synergies. And I just couldn't get the links that you seem to be, or the jumps that you seem to be making.
Right. We were not trying to imply that there is something in IS 36 that is related to synergies. All we were trying to do was to say, okay, if we were to screen, if you will, business combinations under common control for any sort of glaring overpayments or underpayments, how could we do it? What would be the mechanics of doing that? And we've discussed that neither approach, neither mechanical approach would be perfect. All approaches would have their advantages and disadvantages. But applying the impairment test in IS 36 could be potentially one of those approaches. So you acquired a business, you allocated your goodwill to all the CGUs that are expected to benefit, and if you have no impairment, that may suggest that there is no overpayment. But again, this is not an ideal approach, and I don't know if it is helpful to get into detailed discussion of mechanics before we have a shared understanding of how this approach would work. But what I would like to emphasize that it just attempts to consider different mechanics if we wanted to screen for any overpayments. Does it address your question?
Sort of. It's just that when I looked at some of the write-ups of what was presented to the board, I just went, I don't quite get to where you've got to. I can see IS 36 comes in as a way of checking what the values might be, but I wouldn't have written it up as a revised ceiling approach. I would have just said that's what's going to happen. It's just a piece of extra information that's going to happen regardless, because you have to do the impairment test.
I thought my recollection, Yulia, I'm at risk here of not recollecting correctly, but it was really the idea was it was the same mechanics as the usual goodwill impairment test in 36.
Yeah.
It was just what the label might be that would be attached to it in terms of it being a contribution slash distribution, so it wasn't implying...
Instead of impairment, yes. So it's using the mechanics.
I think that was as simple as that in terms of the logic, from my recollection.
Yeah,
because then I wouldn't have said that was a 36 approach. It's just
a payment testing with a different label on it.
Yeah, which I would have followed through.
But if I go back, can I just ask a question while I've got the floor? Your first point, I think, in terms of the protection of non-controlling interests, is your point there questioning the need to really hunt for these under and over payments quite so vigilantly?
Yeah, I would have thought if you're going down the route, I'd have something like there's a rebuttable presumption that the transaction price is fair value. Unless there's some evidence that that's the case, more broadly than what I certainly have seen from my observations in Australia. And I mean, it could quite well be different in China, but my understanding is most times when you're talking about something that's not at fair value, it's going to be in those other transactions where there is no NCI. And it's that horrible substance thing where you're not really sure why people are actually doing the transaction.
Yeah.
And so you come up with some nonsense, well, not nonsense, but there's no real support for the actual transaction price. My other observation is in terms of lenders. Again, I think you need to be clear about if you're looking at lenders, whether it's lenders at the receiving entity level or whether it's actually lenders at the group level.
Well, looking at the receiving entity as well, this presentation.
Yeah, in which case I would certainly share Tommaso's opinion that I'm struggling with how the current value model wouldn't be producing information that's of benefit to lenders as well. Because I would have thought, you know, part of the issue is what are the assets that are actually there that are available to pay back my loans? And I would have thought...
And maybe if I could clarify the point before sort of there is more confusion, our conclusion was not so much about that information would be useful. Sort of our tentative conclusion was that maybe the benefits of this information would not necessarily justify the cost of providing that information for lenders and creditors. And this is because lenders and creditors do not have this sort of residual equity risk, and they do not have indefinite interest. So what we were thinking, and I completely take the point that in this slide deck it's probably not all so clear, but what we're thinking that if you have just lenders and creditors, maybe that information can be provided via disclosure instead of actually recognizing at fair values. Whereas for NCI, maybe recognizing that fair values is more appropriate than just meeting the information needs via disclosures. But I completely agree that it was probably not evident in the slide deck that this is what we had in mind.
Okay. So just historical cost method, I'm struggling with what the historical cost method actually is, because at some point or another, what you pay is historical cost, and your historical cost method seems to be an allocation of cost, which, again... even if you're using the fair value model, it's still an allocation of cost. So I don't get there. And if your starting presumption is that this is a transfer of a business, your so-called historical cost method is basically treating it as if it's a transfer of individual assets and liabilities. So I just don't even know how it gets into the equation of being an option to think about. It just seems completely inconsistent with what your starting presumptions actually are. So we talked about NCI. So I do agree that if you do have unders or overs above fair value, that should be thought of as contributions and distributions. So that, in terms of the conceptual piece, seems right. But as I said, I was really struggling with what your ceilings and your revised ceiling approaches were. So I would certainly not be in favour of those approaches at this particular time. And would certainly agree that if you've got NCI and third parties, that the current value approach is going to give you better information. And as I said, we're probably less concerned because we thought the starting presumption would be if it's NCI, then you're going to have fair value in any case. I think the more interesting question then is, are you going to deal with the other BCUCCs and what you're going to do with those? So New Zealand's comment in terms of the extra ones is that at the moment parties seem to be dealing with finding substance of transactions already. So are we really overcooking this whole process? From the Australian perspective, our concern with the other transactions is probably more the ones that are going to result in an IPO.
Sorry, just to make sure that I follow, what do you mean by other transactions?
So the ones that are not with NCI. So the ones that are genuinely got no interest from third parties. Mm-hmm. So again, it's having to think about, is there really substance there? We've also got similar issues about who's the acquirer. And certainly in an IPO situation, I just find it difficult if you're going to end up with some parts of the entities you're bringing together, some at historical cost and some at fair value. I just don't think that's providing useful information for users. So how you can avoid that, I think, is probably the key thing you need to look at. And also I have similar comments about potential users. I think it would be difficult to say their needs would be different to what your current shareholders are as well. But we seem to be making some progress.
Can I just clarify, Chris, because there was also obviously a lot in what you said and I'm just trying to embrace it. Am I understanding correctly that in a transaction where you have existing NCI, you are supportive of current value accounting?
Yes.
But then it sounds like so the ceiling approach and the revised ceiling approach are not really clear. So if we wanted to look at it, we would need to sort of clarify what we mean. Then I think the other thing that I heard you are saying is that in the context of prospective IPO, you wouldn't support having different sort of entities at different values. So it's either all historical predecessor carrying amount or fair value, I suppose, but at the same basis. Okay. Just clarifying the main points. And this is consistent with our thinking. And again, it may not have been entirely clear in the slide deck, but at least, yeah, those main comments are consistent with where we are.
Patrick.
As regards the stakeholders, I think it is paramount to consider the situation of the non-controlling interests. For us, we make a big difference between a business under common control, without or with. With controlling interest, normally you are under the control of many aspects of corporate law in terms of valuation, in terms of protection, decision-making, etc. So as soon as you have a non-controlling interest involved in a transaction, in a combination of that nature, I think in most jurisdictions you are protected. And therefore, you find yourself in a position where you should be on the basis of an arm's-length transaction. And therefore, the very concept of having a distribution or a contribution seems to be difficult to assume as a starting point. Might be wrong, but because we are developing an accounting concept that would be in conflict with corporate law in many instances. I would say the same for lenders and creditors, because when you have a business combination under common control or without common control, by the way, there are protections for lenders of one entity before they join the other, etc. So for me, the key parameter is existence or not of a non-controlling interest. And in this case, it is difficult not to assume that the price is the current value is not the fair value. So let's be careful before we assume that there are so many situations where it wouldn't be the case, because we would be developing an accounting framework that would differ from legal reality, I think.
That has come up quite a lot at the board meetings. As a consideration, that we know that in many jurisdictions maybe most jurisdictions, at least in developed markets, that there is protection for non-controlling interests. But I guess at the back of our mind, we're also thinking that we are aware of a number of jurisdictions that don't have those protections. But I think you're right, at some point we need to, in Africa, places like there, you know, different parts of the world. So we need to, but at the back of our minds, we do need to think about how we balance the fact that in many cases that probably isn't the case, and in some that it will be. But I think it will be something we have to keep thinking about.
Okay, Sue, but if you want to address the point, make it on the basis of an exceptional case, because I think in the bulk of the significant cases, you would find yourself in a situation where there is a protection.
I think I'm agreeing with you. It's just that I just wanted to make sure that you're aware that it is something we are thinking about, the fact that we know that often it's not, there isn't this disconnect, but we do need to think about cases where it could occur as well, and maybe it's a presumption or something, but we're treating it as an exception, but we are trying to think about that.
Excuse me, if I may. I understand why it's being done, but what is troubling is the fact that it's assumed that it's just another ordinary case. You know, you have when it's equal, when it's higher. So it looks natural. So it seems to be encouraging the fact that, yes, this is a natural situation, when in fact it's an exceptional situation.
No.
Yes, I have a quick question. Our understanding of the conceptual framework being that in this discussion, the controlling party would be primary user, but I think I'm hearing other views at this table. Do you have any views?
Yes, actually, I wanted to comment on something that was said earlier. I just didn't have a chance. So under conceptual framework, controlling party would be a primary user of the receiving entity financial statements. It is an existing equity investor, controlling interest, so it will be a primary user. And building on the discussion that we just had, and I echo what Sue said, that we indeed had a discussion at the board table, how often, you know, combinations under common control would be at sort of fair values when you have NCI protection, when you don't have NCI protection. I would be just curious, you know, if we can take this opportunity, if Christina or Alessandra have any input or feedback about whether those transactions are necessarily always at high value in your jurisdictions, and certainly where I come from, and maybe it has changed in the recent past, but in my jurisdiction, transactions under common control can be at any values, or at least it used to be the case.
Well, while they're thinking about that, can I just add to your first response to Nobu about controlling parties? Because the framework also goes on to say that the financial statements are directed primarily at users who rely only on the financial statements for financial information.
Mm. So controlling do not rely.
So your question is it on listed companies in general?
In general, I suppose, yeah.
Okay. Well, in general, then, yes, we will have a mixed bag of companies that may not be reflecting fair value business.
Right.
But as I said earlier, the listing rules have a requirement where if you are listed, you must be providing the fair valuation information to your shareholders, not just your controlling party.
And does it mean that they must transact at fair value, or does it mean that they must disclose fair value?
I think it's providing the disclosure, because obviously you can transact for the low fair value.
Okay.
But the questions, I mean, the reason for providing the information is so that investors or shareholders can then ask the question, why are you overpaying or underpaying?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Thank you. So cool. Listen, do you have any feedback from?
Okay.
I do have a question, actually. So I understand that the board has moved along, moved away from the revised ceiling approach,
So what the board decided in June is to continue to explore sort of using the acquisition method in IFRS 3 as a basis for accounting for transactions that involve existing NCI, and then think about whether and how that method can be modified. And the board ruled out what we described as a full five-value approach. So this is sort of off the table at the moment, but we will still keep thinking about both ceiling approach and revised ceiling approach, which is not to say that we will go forward with any of those approaches, but at least this is something that we still want to think about more.
So just in case, you know, the model comes back again, so if we look at slides 21 and 22, it may be that we misunderstood about that, but what we understand here is if you are in slide 21, if you are paying more than fair value of acquired business plus the synergy, then you recognize the difference in distribution, while also you would recognize the difference between your net assets, net identifiable fair value assets, difference between that and the, well, somewhere it will go to goodwill. I think there are some practical challenges here.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So we think that, I mean, if we talk to a valuation expert, like they will say they can definitely value the business with or without the synergies, but it will involve a lot of judgment.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. So, but when it comes to then deciding, well, which, what layer or how much is distribution and contribution, I think the company who is probably preparing the information will want to say, well, everything should go to goodwill and there's no over or under. It's just a practical,
yeah,
not no longer a valuation issue. It's just, I think, because you're sending a bad message, I think, if you're actually showing the distribution. And
can I add on something to what Julia said? And again, I'm hoping I'm remembering accurately, but I think I am. So I think where we landed at the last board meeting was to agree that we should, as Julia said, to build on the thinking in IFRS 3 and then to look at some permutations. So some of those permutations might be something along the lines of the ceiling approach or the revised ceiling approach. But also it could be as simple, if I'm remembering correctly, as applying basically IFRS 3 unadjusted with some additional disclosures in these situations, and or just making a smaller tweak such as rather than booking gains on acquisitions for bargain purchases, making those contributions to equity rather than booking gains. So there was a sort of a spectrum between IFRS 3 just with some additional disclosure all the way through to some other permutations and some variations between, partly acknowledging some of the points that some of you guys have raised about measurement uncertainty, but also should we be starting off with the assumption of there definitely being mismatches between the fair values and the considerations, et cetera, et cetera. So I think we're looking at a spectrum of possibilities. Is that right, Julia?
Yeah, completely. And we fully agree about measurement uncertainty point that came up in our discussions quite a bit. Yeah.
So I think AOS, as you will agree with the direction that you're taking,
yeah.
Because I think the revised ceiling approach and the revised models that you've got here is actually a little more complicated than what they would expect. They, if you're giving them a choice, IFRS 3 unmodified and others, they would say, well, everyone's familiar with IFRS 3, so why don't we go with that and have more disclosures that will, you know, then provide investors some more useful information. I don't know if you're taking the question on what disclosures will be useful, but definitely purpose of what, like, you know, purpose of the transaction and the assumptions. So if we are using IFRS 3 and modify the assumptions that are underlying the fair values, would be useful to the investors.
Be careful with disclosure overload, eh?
Yeah.
I just wanted to echo something what Christina just said. We had a meeting in June, joint CMAC GPF discussion, and one of the points that came up at that meeting, very similar, IFRS 3 is familiar ground, people understand it, don't tinker much with IFRS 3. So that's consistent feedback.
Yes.
I just echo that. I think, again, you're looking at that slide 21, and that was part of the reason why I was trying to understand synergies to start with. It doesn't seem appropriate to me that you'd be recognising goodwill based on something more than the fair value of the acquired business. So I don't think you've made the argument why that information would be more important in these types of transactions than it would be in an IFRS 3.
But just to be very clear, I think there is a lot of misunderstanding about this slide, because under IFRS 3, this is exactly what would happen. IFRS 3 recognized goodwill will be the difference between considerations that you pay and fair value of identifiable net assets. So that difference would include any synergies that are sort of part of this combination. So that element is no different from IFRS 3.
But I think if you looked at your slide and you've got that sort of blue box, that's where I would have said IFRS 3 came across, which is the fair value of the acquired business.
This is not what is intended. So if I can take you, because I think like being on the same page is really important, if I can take you to slide 12... So on slide 12, two left-hand side columns is what essentially assumed in IFRS 3. So consideration, fair value of the consideration transferred would be equal to fair value of your acquired interest that could include combination synergies that are part of the payment. So that analysis is no different from IFRS 3. And I think the best we could help is just to provide some narrative for a future meeting, which obviously it wasn't very clear.
I think it's creating... took me 2 months to understand that.
Okay, good. I feel better.
Maybe it's better to take it offline, yeah.
Okay. The IFRS 13 fair value of the acquired business would include a market participant perspective on synergies.
Market participant, but not unique to the combination. Yeah.
Which is why I would have put it in the blue box and not...
Yeah, so would I. Put it in a different box.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. Well, thank you very much, Julia. We'll move to the next point on the agenda, which